G'day, I'm Will Anderson. Welcome to Willosophy Plugs Up the Front. You know how this works. My new show is called Will Informed, and it's on in Hobart, March the 8th, and then at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. That is on sale, selling the fastest of any of my shows ever, which is brilliant. So I would love if that could continue. Today's guest on the podcast, just one of my favorite people in the world, super, super funny. She has a Netflix special that you'd have to watch. She's going to be on a new tour around the country. We're going to talk about that. But what we didn't really mention was her kids' book, which is called George and the Great Bum Stampede. And so I wanted to give that a proper plug up the front. So if you have kids and you want a book for your kids, George and the Great Bum Stampede is the name of the book. Kel Wilson is the guest on the podcast today, and she's the best, and you're going to love this. And look, you know, all I would say is stay until the end because it gets a little emotional at the end. Hope you enjoy today's podcast. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and I feel very professional today because we're in an actual radio studio. Have done one of these in a radio studio before, but last time I did it in a radio studio, it was just with my podcast equipment that I just was using in a radio studio. But today we're in a radio studio using actual radio studio equipment. So this may well be the best episode of this podcast you have ever heard. And it probably is going to be because of our guest today. And this is how the podcast starts. Guest, who are you?
I am Kel Wilson. I am a stand-up comedian. I am a writer and I am a kids book author.
Okay. Well, all that is very exciting. Is writer and kids book author separate things?
Yeah, because you know, because I've written columns and stuff like that before and written for TV shows. But having a published book is different.
I feel like I'm the only comedian who doesn't have a kids book at the moment.
Come on.
I mean, well, I don't have a kid either. Is that creepy if I start coming out with kids books and I don't have a kid?
Okay, so your niche is going to be writing books for people's pets. Yep. So you are going to be like the pet author. So you're going to be doing books for people that's like, and then Chili said, you know, like, so you're going to be doing, you're going to be communicating directly with the pet, and the people that don't have children will be like, I fucking love Will Anderson. He's just, that's something for us.
Well, you know what it is too, because it's a good target market because you're selling a kid's book, right?
Yeah.
The problem with that is that people are spending, you know, money on their kids as well, you know, they don't have as much disposable income. Whereas I'm pitching to rich idiots who want to pamper their dog or cat by reading them a book specifically designed to them.
Exactly. And they'll already be at the dog cafe. They will have bought the dog biscuits and the dogachino and you're laughing.
Kel, the way this podcast works is I ask people if they have a philosophy towards something. A life philosophy of some kind, and then we just sort of chat. So let's start there, and then we'll just chat about all sorts of nonsense.
All right. So my philosophy is, if you can make something better for someone, why wouldn't you?
Okay, I like that. That's very good already. So where does that come from? How long do you reckon you've had that philosophy for?
I don't know, but I think like it kind of ties in with the way I feel about doing comedy, which is I want everyone to walk out feeling better than they did when they walked in. Like I want everyone to leave feeling happy as well as that they've laughed, you know, like so. And I reckon maybe it comes from being a people pleaser all my life. Maybe that's part of it. But also I've got a really kind mum. And I think as I get older, I appreciate that more in her and I get a real kick out of being able to do stuff for people and making things a bit better for other people.
Okay, so I love the idea of the kind mum for a start. Yeah. So let's start there because I think that I have a kind mum as well. Mm. If I was going to, you know, come up with a word that summed up my mum and it immediately came to mind, kind would be certainly in the mix of words that I would choose. And I think that it's an amazing gift to give a child to be a kind mum, you know, even though my mum and I are very different in a lot of different ways. And certainly her life experience is very different to the life experience that I have. Her kindness is something that I've tried to take with me into those various different situations without even ever consciously knowing it. Like it took me a long time. It probably took me until I was in my mid-30s, 40s to realize that that was where it came from and why I was striving to bring that kindness to those situations and why in situations where I wasn't being kind, it feels horrible,
doesn't it? It feels horrible. Yeah.
I would often look jealously at other people who could be, you know, cruel so casually. I was like, I could be cruel and I have, but you know, just like they seem to be like yeah. fine with being cruel, whereas I would be cruel and then I would feel terrible about it for the rest of my life.
Yeah, think about it at night at like 4 a.m. and go, oh, I said terrible things to those girls at high school. You know, like, yeah.
I literally have that flashback quite a lot. I said terrible things to those girls at high school. So where did that kindness manifest itself for you? Tell me a bit about what it was like growing up for you. In New Zealand,
yes,
obviously.
Yeah, in Christchurch.
So what was that like? Tell me what young life for you was like.
What was it like? It was, I always think, very flat. Like Christchurch is like it's on the plains. It's quite a conservative place. And it's really different now. It's weird talking about Christchurch because Christchurch now is so altered post-earthquake to the Christchurch that I grew up in. So it's an entirely different city now. Like Christchurch, for me, was a very safe, stable, boring sort of place. We had two places that we went on holiday. It was Akaroa or Oamaru. I feel like I had quite a routine childhood. And I just was always attracted to performance. Like that was always something. Like I can still remember laughing at something on TV for the first time, and it was at a Benny Hill joke, which is...
Do you remember what the joke was?
It was a guy riding a horse, a highwayman riding away on a horse, and he pulled a string and the horse's tail came up and a gun came out of its ass and it shot the people who were following him. And I thought that was gold.
I mean, some humour doesn't age very well, but I think I would still enjoy that if I saw that.
Yeah, just the unexpected nature of the horse's tail going up, bang, it's like, brilliant.
Mm. So you laughter was important. Were your parent was your family situation one that where laughter was celebrated?
Yeah. So my dad's side, I feel like I get warmth from my mum's side, and wit from my dad's side. Like, so my dad's family are all great talkers. Like, and I used to do a joke about it that we didn't have conversations; we'd have tag team monologue. So. Everyone just talks until I run out of breath and then the next person jumps in. Like, so big family of storytellers. Dad loves a pun. Like, I love wordplay from my dad, all that kind of thing. And so family gatherings were always lots of laughter and, just great stories that you would hear over and over again kind of thing. And I think I get that love of talking for a long time, but I've contained it by doing it on stage when people want that to happen.
Yeah, I've got to say that, I mean, the monologue-to-monologue way of conversing would have got you used to some comedy green rooms.
Yeah.
Because quite a lot of the time in a comedy green room, particularly early on, people are only listening to you to know when you stop so they can start talking.
Yes, they can tell you their story, yeah. And my thing that I always used to think was I'd meet a new comedian from overseas or something and I'd be like, well, they're torn because I'm a woman, so they don't know whether they should hit on me or tell me how great they are. which do they start with? Do they hit on me to get that out of the way or do they tell me about their amazing career? Or can we combine the two?
So dad's family is the wit side, mum's family is the warmth side.
Yeah,
it's a good combination to be a performer. So how early on did you make that transition in your head from going, I enjoy watching performance, to thinking maybe performance is something that I would enjoy doing myself?
I reckon I was quite young. I was at primary school. I remember writing a play. Like, we wrote a play and we did it at the end of the year. My first performance role was as the Virgin Mary in the Nativity play in my first year at school, and I rode another child as a donkey. That's all I remember about that.
I mean, you've got the starring role in that.
Absolutely.
And the other kid has got the worst role in that.
Yeah. I mean, I was a small child, so it wasn't like... I'm imagining they chose a heftier child in the class.
But... I mean, again, poor hefty child. Yeah. You're some poor hefty child. You've gone off to primary school and now you have to play the donkey in the nativity.
Yeah, don't get any lines. You just got to be hefty. Yeah. But poor hefty child is a great name to have in the credits or something. So I remember loving showing off, like being a show off at home. And I remember doing an improvised play with my older brother where the characters were polystyrene cups that I had drawn faces on and we were behind the table. And so I'd be like, and now you say this. And then he'd say whatever boring thing I had him say. And then I'd say something. It was like an entirely improvised play that must have felt like it went for hours. But I remember just loving that feeling of being in control of the attention that's paid to you.
So at primary school, what other areas of interest did you have? Like, tell me what – so you're going to primary school in Christchurch?
Yep.
And is it a big school?
No, probably not by Australian standards. Quite a small school. Yeah, a small school. Like, I go back now because my nephews have been through that same primary school, and it's tiny, and the hall feels like a doll's house. You know, it is a small school, but at the time it felt plenty big enough.
So was your school experience a fun one? Were you like a kid that easily fit in with other people? Were you someone who, like, you know, felt, you know, well-liked at primary school? Was primary school a fun experience for you?
I think I got bored by it. Like, I think, like, talking about it with my mum later, like, I'd say I felt sick a lot and didn't want to go to school, but I think it was just because it wasn't challenging, maybe. And also, like, as much as I love performing, I'm quite shy, and I was very shy, I think, as a child. And so I wasn't one of those people that could walk up to a group of kids and be like, hey, I'm here, kind of thing. So it took me a while, I think, to feel comfortable with other kids. And there were, like, I remember one or two times there was a guy called Robert who was a large, hefty child. And he, like, I remember him pushing me into
the one
road.
From the play?
I don't know. I mean, like, it would be perfect if it was. Right. But I think it was a different kid. But he was obviously trying to cut quite a troubled kid looking back. But I remember him pushing me on the road and, you know, ripping my brown tights and crying, and but then not telling anyone about it. You know, like the things that happen as a kid that it doesn't occur to you to say to anyone else. You know, like we had a teacher at primary school who would, like, feel the girls' backs to see if any of them were old enough to wear bras yet. And we just were like, oh, we just keep out of his way. But it never occurred to us to say anything about it. You know, like as an adult, I go, we should have probably let someone know that was happening, because if that was happening, who knows what else was happening. But as a kid, I think you just think that you have to deal with it.
So, I mean, you're a parent.
Yeah.
You know, do you, how do you, like, process that when you remember what it was like for you at, like, that primary school age, when you have children, you know, who, you know, primary school, and how do you encourage, then pass on what you've learned or your experience of that, you know, to your children with how to deal with those sort of situations?
The thing that I'm really conscious of with my son is that I am always saying to him, you know that you can tell us anything and we are always on your side. Mm. Like, you know that, like, whatever you have to tell us or whatever you have to tell me, I'll always be on your side. So I'm, you know, he goes to a great little school. But I'm conscious of stuff like that, because I, you know, I look back, and he's quite like me. Like, he's a big thinker. Like, I can see that overthinking gene in him already that my whole family has of, like, you know, anxiety. It's basically anxiety. And I can see that he could go down that path as well. So I'm kind of trying to head stuff off at the pass, knowing what I was like as a kid.
It's an interesting one, isn't it, though? Because I think there is so much, you know, shame in, like, sometimes with your parents, and it's so weird because your parents, of course, you know, love you more
love
than
you.
Anybody
yeah,
else
yeah.
And they want to know what's going on, and they would hate the idea that you're being, you know, pushed onto the road, you know, by some hefty boy, and that you're keeping it to yourself,
yeah.
You know, but that you feel that you can't tell them for whatever reason. So when you say to your son, you know, you can tell us anything, you know, do you feel like he believes that is true?
I think so. And I think also I pick my time with it. Like, our time to have a conversation is when he's gone to bed and he's also delaying having the lights turned out, kind of thing like that. But we'll kind of talk about the day and talk about stuff. And that's when often we have really good conversations about things, because something will occur to him and then we'll just keep talking about stuff.
How do you deal with answering questions from your kid that you may not know the answer to?
I say, I don't know, let's go and Google it. Like, so if it's a factual thing, I go, I'm not really sure, this is what I think, but we can Google it when we get home. But if it's something like, you know, he asked me how babies were made and I was surprised.
You'd be like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's go Google it.
Let's Google it.
It happened.
I hear they have some films. So I told him the first time and then he forgot it. Like, because the thing that I've discovered is that you can have a conversation with your kid and you go, well, that's that sorted out. And then, like, 6 months later, they'll come back and they've probably forgotten what you said, kind of. So I had a conversation with him. He said, how do people have babies? And so I was flustered. Like, I was like, oh, shit, I thought I had more time to do this, but it's here. And so I started off. And I was really disappointed. It was like, oh, you know, the dad's got some ingredients and the mum's got some ingredients. And I was like, it's not a cake. We're not making a cake.
No.
And so I had a conversation. So I did it quite sort of anatomically correctly for, like, this is a traditional way of making babies. So that, you know, involving a man and a woman, and this is a traditional way of doing it. And I talked about penises, vaginas, and ovary and sperm and things like that. And at the end of it, he went, "Well, that sounds disgusting. I hope they've found a better way to do it by the time I've grown up." So, which is now a fantastic piece of stand-up. So he's, you know, he's earning his keep. But like sometimes, yeah. And we
you're like, comedy festival's coming up. What else do you need to know about?
Yes. What's troubling you, my darling?
You're fine if I record our nighttime conversations, right?
Well, half of my Netflix special is a story about Digby being a ghost, which is, he's got such a great imagination. And that's the real joy for me of being a parent, is watching this person blossom into who they are, and just that their mind goes to places that you've never expected it to go, or that you'll have conversations that are quite tricky or that are just so gorgeous that it's really hard to not laugh at them because they're so innocent and hilarious. Like, since I've had Digby, I've realised how much my mum must have laughed over my head as she was hugging me, as I was crying about something stupid. Like, you know, like we took him to a museum once and he got scared by a horse talking, like it was like a talking model. And it was a really awful situation because he was scared of it. And I was like, no, we'll pat the horse's nose, it'll be fine. And I held him up to pat the horse and then it started talking and he just lost his shit, like completely freaked out. And it was hilarious. Like, I was like, oh no, poor Digby's just had this terrible scarring experience. It was dreadful, but also so funny. Like, just the timing was impeccable. Like, as a piece of comedy theatre, it was perfect. And that thing of being simultaneously feeling sympathy and love for this small child, but also going, oh my God, that was hilarious.
How do you, you mentioned the Netflix special and you mentioned the material in the Netflix special. What is your conversation with yourself about what's appropriate to use that involves someone who hasn't signed up necessarily for being
given
in
his
the
consent.
Show.
Yeah.
Right?
So the stories that I tell about him, he's always the hero. Mm. So there's never, I mean, there's stories that I will tell you off air about him, which I would never do on air because he's vulnerable in those stories. But, you know, things like the, I hope they've found a better way to do it by the time I've grown up. Like, he's got a great line. Like, he's had a great line in it. And the story that I tell in the Netflix special is just gorgeous. He used to pretend to be a ghost, and I just watched the show.
It's available on Netflix. Yeah. It's all around the world, Netflix.
So he used to pretend to be a ghost, and what I loved about talking to the ghost was that he had an answer for everything. And so he told me that his name was Jordan Doorbell, and that he'd invented the doorbell, and that he's got cousins Tony and Ethan Doorbell that lived down the road. But when he died, he didn't give them any money because they were assholes, and he's left all his money to the RSPCA, and all like just beautiful. Yeah. But the convention was that I had to pretend I couldn't see the ghost and or wonder where Digby had gone, kind of thing. And so the ghost was around for quite a while. And then we had a conversation one day as Digby about the tooth fairy. And he wanted to know if the tooth fairy was real. And I said, do you want the truth? He said, yes. And so I said, it doesn't exist. And he goes, oh, well, that means that Santa and the Easter Bunny aren't real either.
Ooh,
and I was like, oh,
that's smart.
Shit. Like,
he got you. Because he thought you'd give you the soup, like the tooth fairy.
Yeah.
But if you'd gone in hard on Santa, you might have held on to it a little bit.
Yeah, but he got the whole cast. Like, just does not believe in the whole cast. And so Chris and I, my husband and I, had a massive fight about it because he was really upset that I had kind of destroyed Christmas. And my thing was, he asked for the truth. And I told him the truth, and then he worked it out for himself. And so we had a big, like, probably the worst argument we've ever had in 15 years of being together about what I should have done in that moment. And I was adamant that I wasn't going to lie to him.
What age is he when this is happening?
He's eight. Okay. Which I think is a reasonable time to, I think I was eight when I worked it out.
Well, you and Donald Trump agree on that, apparently.
Oh, really?
That was the kid was about eight, wasn't it? Oh, no, the kid was 12 or something, I think, but...
Don't say I agree with Donald Trump on anything, please, Will. It's very upsetting.
Well, you were just saying before that you wanted to build a wall around Australia to keep New Zealanders out. I mean, you said it.
And my hands are minuscule.
Yeah.
So after the argument, I go and see Digby and I go, Dad's a bit annoyed with me because I told you the truth about Santa. And he goes, never mind, but since I've told you something, would you like me to tell you something?
Yeah.
And I went, okay, what do you want to tell me? And he goes, there is no ghost. I am Jordan Doorbell. I have never loved him so much as I loved him in that moment.
I mean, it's an amazing story.
It's considerably longer on Netflix with more gags, but Like, I was just like his mind, like his beautiful little mind, and the fact that in his mind we're on a level and I've treated him like an adult, so he's going to treat me like an adult. Like, we're, you know, we're mates, we can talk about this sort of stuff. But the weird thing now is, like, a year and a half later, he claims not to remember Jordan Doorbell. Like, he has a vague memory of being the ghost, and he's back to believing in Santa again.
Well, because he's worked out he's smart enough to work out that if you believe in Santa, you're going to
get more presents.
Get more presents, exactly.
Yeah, but like, so my husband was like, I don't understand what's happening. And I was like, neither do I, but we'll just go with it. Like, whatever he wants to do, that's fine.
That's interesting to me, though. Does he have an awareness that you talk about him in your
act?
Yeah.
So I'll say, I told a story about you on stage today.
And he's okay with that?
Yeah, he's like, did they laugh? Like, I'm like, yeah. He's seen me do stand-up once at the Queenscliff Music Festival. It was like a morning show, and it was sort of allegedly PG. And his takeaway from that was that I said shit, which he was like, I can't believe you said shit. And I said to him, I only say it at work, and I never say it when I'm at home. And he was like, that's fair enough. So my justification, like, I never do it in front of hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And Justin Hamilton said piss, and that was the highlight of his life up to that point. Like, that was, Tom Ballard did this fantastic stuff about being at a gay club and stuff that all went over Digby's head and everything, but Justin saying piss was like magnificent. Bravo.
It's interesting to me that, though, because our job is a bit of an unconventional job for, I mean, I guess maybe lots of people's jobs are unconventional for their children to understand, because I grew up, you know, with farmers as parents.
Yeah.
So I was very aware of what my parents' job was because it happened where we live.
Yeah, you're immersed in it, aren't you?
And I was taken to it quite often.
Yeah.
So if Dad told me he was going to milk cows, I knew exactly what that looked like. Or if he was going to, like, you know, do the irrigation, or, you know, go and whatever it was that he was doing on the farm.
Yeah, you've got concrete experience of that.
I literally had been in the tractor with him while he baled hay or whatever. I understood what it was, even if I didn't necessarily understand how to do it. Mm. Whereas I guess for a whole lot of jobs, if your dad's an accountant or whatever, he leaves in the morning, he gets home at night, or you know, whatever, you don't necessarily know. But I think that our job, you know, particularly the stand-up part of our job, is one of those things that, because it's probably not appropriate for young people either, it's a long while before they're introduced to it.
Yes.
My nephew Riley came and saw, he's like 12, he's just going into high school now, so just this year. And so he came and saw my show at the festival this time for their very first time. And you could see something very much change in his mind between what he obviously thought my job was and what he saw that my job actually is.
And also, I imagine for him, seeing all of those people adoring his uncle, like, and being impressed by his uncle, like, that's a different, that puts you in a different context from Uncle Will, who comes around to his house. Like, that's a whole, it's a whole different, it like, that makes you quite powerful.
I guess it is. Like, I mean, it's hard to imagine what it's like from a young person's experience. But I imagine even weirder, though, if that person happens, like, he kind of gets that, you know, I'm on the TV and I have a radio show. They sometimes listen to that, you know, but if it's your mum, you know, like, if it's your dad, like, I imagine there's a whole different step to that. Or is it just normal because it's all he's ever known?
It's all he's ever known. So, like, he hasn't come and seen a show of mine. Imagine if Riley had come and seen you when he was 3 or 4 or something like that. He'd be like, oh, that's just what Uncle Will does. Like, so Digby is entirely unimpressed by what I do. Like, he's got, it's of no interest to him whatsoever. You know, like, all he is excited about is, does it mean we get to stay in a hotel? Like, if I take him with me to a gig, he's like, well, this hotel's not very good. Like, he's got many opinions about how many stars hotel should have. So he has, like, he loves that aspect of it. He's so funny. But he is not impressed that I have been on TV or the radio or that I do shows. But I imagine when he is older as a teenager, I will be the most mortifying thing that has ever happened. And then later on, he might get a feeling for it. But I think it's just what his mum does. So that's what people's parents do, you know, like, so that's what Claire Hooper does, or, you know, like my friends, that's just what people's parents do. It's not a weird thing. I'm glad that he stopped describing it as my mummy does shows, because I feel like that has a late night element to it that perhaps And my favourite thing was the hardest gig I've had to do in recent years was go and talk to his school about my job. So they asked if I'd come along and talk
great.
To the kids.
No, I want to hear all about this.
So from like preppies to, I think it was grade one to grade six.
And was this just you speaking just or was me. It a range of...
Okay, no, it was just me. Just so you. It was like people's parents coming in to talk about their jobs and then it was my turn. And so it was like, I don't know, 150 kids or something like that. And one of the teachers said, and like everybody knows me at school because it's a tiny school, it's only 200 kids there and I'm Digby's mum. And so I went in and one of the teachers went, we wanted to play some of your clips to the kids before you came in, but there was none that we could use. And I was like, I'm sorry about that.
That's at primary school. Yeah. I often go on TV shows that say we couldn't find anything that we could use.
So I had a chat to them and it was great. It was really, they were really interested in it. And then the question and answer session was basically just different children asking if I knew Hamish and Andy. So the like, do you know who?
Did you say?
Yeah, I go, yes, I work with them. Yes. Or what famous people have you met? Mm. And then thinking, oh, what famous people do you know at your age that would the people I'm impressed by you won't be impressed by? So I was like, well, Lady Gaga, ooh. Like, and then my favourite questions were, how old are you and what's your favourite food? So,
well, how old are you?
I'm 48.
And what is your favourite food?
I think I said it was Thai.
Oh, really?
Like all of Thai, all of Thailand's food.
I mean, also, that's not really impressive to primary school children,
no,
Thai.
It's not. Oh, maybe if I'd said like, you know, like scorpions or something like that, it would have been more exciting.
Okay, so you primary school, you know, feels like it was an okay experience for you. It feels like you had some good feelings about that. How was the transition into senior school?
Well, we have this thing in New Zealand called intermediate school.
Oh, tell me what that is.
So that's 2 years of school that's not primary school and not secondary school.
Oh,
so
you crazy Kiwis.
I know. So you go to grade four and then you go to intermediate school for grade five and six and then you start at grade seven. But we also start at the age of five. You start, I think this still happens. I don't know. I haven't asked a child about this, but when I went to school in New Zealand, you start the day you turn five. So your whole...
the day?
Yeah.
So not at the start of the year.
No, just you start on your
randomly
birthday.
Whenever you... What a way to ruin your birthday for a start.
No, it's exciting because you go to school and then you're like, oh, this happens every day.
Yeah. Every day's your birthday in that you're going to school.
Yeah. Except for Saturday and Sunday. So the class would get bigger over the year. And then, like, my birthday's in October, so I had, like, a little bit of extra prep because I wasn't old enough to go on to the next class. But yeah, so I find it so weird that you'd start school at six and that you all start at the same time. Like, it's like, but you just start when you turn five. Like,
I mean, I isn't that a great example though of you think something's weird if it's not the way you were raised?
Absolutely.
Because hearing you describe that to me, I'm like, that is the stupidest, craziest system of all time. Yep. Some poor kid who's been there from January, like with three other people, who's learned
by December, there's 4,000 children.
All idiots. None of them know what's going on. They've only been there a week.
Yep.
None of them can read.
Yeah, but yeah, it's exactly like that. But that just seemed like a normal thing. Intermediate school.
Yeah, so you do intermediate school. Yeah. Which is that the same place or at a
different school? Different school. So it's kind of weird. I suppose you have these little tiny schools that are only 2 years worth of kids. And I loved intermediate school. I had a couple of really great teachers and that's where I started doing drama.
Okay.
Properly.
So drama as a course.
As an after school activity thing.
Yep.
And I met a couple of friends there that I still have. Like, it was a little tiny school. I really enjoyed it. There was like, I didn't start playing the flute until I went to high school. Oh no, I started playing it at intermediate school. Yeah. So I was like getting music lessons, which I never practiced for. And it was an entire waste of money. I'm very sorry, Barbara and Graham.
That kind of creativity is pretty much all music lessons for most children,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
I think it's rare. Occasionally you get a kid who practices their, you know, for their music lessons, but mostly it's parents wasting money on things that'll never be used again.
And that I bitterly regret now. Like how great to be able to accompany myself in a comedy song for my job. But
so much of... Like, I mean, every day at school we had French lessons. I would give somebody $10,000 right now if I could, like, speak some French.
Just go over and do some gigs in France.
I would love to. I'd love to be able to speak French. They taught us Japanese at school. I didn't listen because I thought, why would I ever want to speak another language? Right? Like, oh, yeah. If I could go back and tell myself to pay attention to things that I would like to know now that they were trying to teach me for free. And I was like, no, la, 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 la.
And have you started saying that to young people that you know? Like, have you started to go, look, if you can learn to revise as you go and you don't cram before your last exam, it will stand you in really good stead? Like, I remember trying to urgently communicate to a friend's kid of like, don't, I know you're really bright, but just study all you can. And if you get into the habit of good deadlines, it'll be really great. And he's like,
Yeah. So, I wanted to talk about that because I think that there is something, particularly in the music thing, where I'm the same. I did organ lessons, not piano. We didn't have piano. We had organ. electric keyboard, really. You know, I guess it was.
So was it one of those ones that's in the family room and it's got all of the layers of keyboards and the stops and stuff like that? It's like a Hammond or something.
Well, it wasn't quite that. It wasn't quite as old school as the one you're imagining. But imagine a cheaper, more modern version of what you're imagining.
So when you switch it on, it doesn't go, ooh, you don't have that kind of hum.
No, but it wasn't much advanced from that.
Right.
So yeah, in a linear sort of sense, you're in the right zone.
Yeah, but not just quite the right era.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine a cheap knockoff of that.
Yeah.
Imagine the Matt Blatt version of whatever that organ is.
It's the one that Country Target got.
Yeah, like exactly. Very much. Yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly. So I did that and I also played the flute.
Did you?
Yes. The least practical of all musical instruments.
And a horrible sounding instrument. I don't like the flute.
I don't know why it's
too breathy.
Well, I just don't know why it's an instrument that anyone ever encourages children to play.
There's always 47 flutes in junior orchestra.
I don't. Why? Why is there? Flute is not like, it's not something that for the rest of your life in any way, the
you'll
skills
pick up
that
a
you
flute,
pick up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we're sitting around a campfire. I'll just get my flute out. That never happens.
There's always a guitar.
Always a guitar.
Teach 95% of people guitar.
I wish I'd learnt the guitar. I wish that's the one I'd learnt.
Guitar, drums, anything that's around all the time that people still use. But why are you teaching people flute? It is an unnecessary skill. It has no life purposes.
No, none.
Flutes are really expensive. They sound terrible most of the time until you're good at it.
Yes.
Like the only people who make the flute sound good are the people who are world-class flautists. Like it's a terrible instrument up until that point.
And also, how did it get designed the way it's designed? So it's designed to stick out the side of your head. So why would you not hold it in front of you like a recorder or an oboe or a clarinet or all those other instruments that make sense? It's like there's just always been too many flutes and you need it to be at the side so there's enough room for everybody to sit close or something like
You don't have to breathe in a way that is applicable for
anything,
other instrument.
Anything.
Because if you learn how to play like, you know, the trumpet, you can play the trombone. Right? Yep. If you learn how to play the clarinet, you can play the oboe. You learn how to play the flute.
Oh, you can play the piccolo.
Yeah. That's right. A smaller flute. Your only other option is a smaller flute.
Yeah. And like, what are the great flute pieces? Like, you're not going to be playing Smoke on the Water or, you know, it's not a rock instrument. I think Jethro Tull was like the last time.
The fact that we both went to the same reference indicates. And there was some sexy flautist who did albums at one stage. Oh. She was like, her name might have been Jane somewhere or someone. And she was like you know how there's always like a Nigel Kennedy or whatever who's
A Richard Clayderman.
Yeah. They've taken like an instrument that's normally quite boring and they're the kind of rock and roll version of like Yo-Yo Ma or these sort of people.
Yeah.
And you always know one person who plays that instrument. There was a woman called, I reckon, Jane someone, who was famous for like being naked on the front of her flute albums in a tasteful way.
You get very hot when you play the flute though, so it's fair enough. Just the worst. And I've still got the flute that my parents bought me and I tried to play it the other day and it was a shit flute back then and I cannot get a sound out of it.
I don't have the flute because I know that when I went to university, I hocked my flute for money. Yeah, went to cash converters. My flute.
Wow.
Probably still sitting there.
Wonder
because I can't imagine anyone's gone in for a secondhand flute.
I'll go and take mine and they'll be like, we've got Will Anderson's flute right here.
The only thing I liked about flute lessons was I was the only man in, as I would have been at that stage. I was the only boy in the class. So I did actually.
Discovered it early on.
Yeah. I did pick up a few, like, you know, probably a little bit of inside knowledge about, you know, the women and what they were really talking about.
Yep.
Because if you're the only man in a group of women, eventually they kind of forget that you're there and they just start talking like they talk themselves. Yep. And so I did pick up some handy information.
What did you pick up? Is there anything that sticks out?
I mean, you know what it is? It was all the misconception stuff. Like it would give me a better insight into, because quite a lot of the time, particularly, you know, in those early teen years, there are just so many misconceptions about what one side believes and what the other, like what boys and girls believe even in the same situation, the way that things are being interpreted are so diametrically opposite that they don't even occur to you.
Yes.
You know, as in like, you know, the boy will never occur to the boy that it's not like the boy's overlooking the way that
no,
girl
no,
is
just
thinking.
Not even a thing
because
you've
it's
had to
not
think
even
about.
Occurred to them that would be a thing that they were thinking and vice versa.
Yes.
And so it gave me a little bridge between those two to realize that somehow there were at least other things that could be considered.
Yep.
You know, even if I was not, you know, evolved in any way enough to understand the deepness and complexity of what those things were or to be able to consider them, to at least be alerted to the fact that they existed was in of itself, you know, interesting.
And I imagine also giving you opportunity to understand that girls were people as well and you could talk to them.
Oh, and I'd always actually had a reasonable capacity to talk with girls. I was your perfect sort of person to talk with girls because I was, you know, reasonably well educated compared to some of the other, you know, boys of my age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly wasn't that sort of weird mess of like sporty, you know, hormones of like wanting to punch you and run away sort of. That wasn't my, I was a bit more, you know, chubbier, nerdier, you know, used my wit, you know.
Yes.
That was quite an attractive proposition for,
So
I was a non-threatening man.
I was going to say non-threatening man. So were you a chubby child?
Yes.
So this is my...
In my intermediate years.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So, I feel that often people who are good looking straight away often are able to rely on being good looking straight away. But if you are chubby or clumsy or you have some other thing, it requires you to develop your personality. And I think it's an advantage when you get good looking, you've also got a personality. What an incredibly massive generalization I've just made that's probably upset so many hot people who go, I also have a personality.
No, hot people don't listen to podcasts.
It's a very good point.
This is a really good place to really good place to put that opinion out in a very safe environment where no hot person is ever going.
Yeah.
The only way a hot person will have heard that is if they're actually driving past another car that's listening to it right
and
now.
Yeah, they've got it turned up really loud.
They're on their way to the beach and there's a pause in the dance music that they're blasting over their Coronas
and
they're drinking
convertible,
in the background.
The convertible has got the roof down so they can hear it really easily. Yeah.
What did she just say? That's okay. I'm beautiful. Look back in the mirror. Yeah. I agree with you to a certain extent, you know, which is that idea that, and it's particularly, I think, probably damaging for, and I hope this is probably changing, but, you know, there used to be that thing of like, particularly the girl who was, you know, hot at high school.
Yeah.
Lived in a world where you never understood, because doors would just naturally open for you, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody would do, you know, what it was that you wanted to do. And that's not the fault of that person.
No,
you know,
but it's
they
just
start to live in a world where
it's easy.
It's easy.
Yeah.
You know, they start to live in a world where they walk into the dressing room and the fruit platter's there and they assume the fruit platter is for them. Because why wouldn't it be? Because it always is.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the person who doesn't grow up like that, you know, has a different perspective on
that
world.
Yeah, they're always like, oh, I'm so sorry, someone's left a fruit platter here. Yeah. Is this in the wrong room?
Yeah, whose fruit platter is this? Would anyone like some of the fruit?
Yeah.
You guys want some fruit as well, right?
This must be some terrible prank. Why have you left this fruit? It's poisoned. Yep.
So, okay. So you get to high school after intermediate school.
Yep.
You're playing the flute.
Yep.
What else are you doing?
I think I'm in the drama. There's a major production every second year at the school that I went to. And so I think, this is controversial. We did a musical called Showboat. And this is Christchurch in 1984. And there weren't enough black people in Christchurch. So we were, we played the black children, the African-American children, and we were coloured with makeup.
Blackface is what you're saying.
Blackface.
You wore blackface.
And I'm so grateful that social media did not exist in 1984. But we were blacked up as, and they were referred to as coloured folk in the songs and stuff. Like looking back, like that's only 1984. Like that's pretty bad.
Yeah. Or it's book week in Australia like 2 years ago. So.
Oh God. And it's every time that happens, and because it does happen every time, I'm like, have you not been listening? Like
And it's always
amazing.
Book week. Someone's
coming.
Someone's come and ruined book week with another blackface incident.
And it's not the kids' fault. It's the parent that's gone, oh, picked on, you're a bit of fun, or nobody really likes him. Like, there's always some dumb reason.
Well, here's, I have a very similar experience. You know, again, often, like on this podcast, what we're dealing with is that idea of going, how much can you blame someone for doing something when they did not know that it was the wrong thing to do, versus people who then continue to do that thing once they know it's the wrong thing to do, right? And they are two different states.
Yeah.
I think you can forgive people a lot of things for what they did not know was true at the time.
As long as they learn, like as long, like if I was like, oh, I'm going to reboot Showboat and I'm going to do the same thing again, like, oh, I am despicable. But it's like, you know, well, you don't know and now you know. So this is your chance to get better, kind of.
So we did The King and I at high school.
Right.
And the king in The King and I is from, he's the king of Siam. And so I played the king in The King and I, and I yellowed up. So, yeah, it was like a fake tan. It was like, you know, sort of old school orange fake tan. Not in the face, which, again, must have been a weird and confusing look.
Your body was...
Yeah, because the uniform was much like... much like what you would imagine, the costume was that, like what you would imagine MC Hammer would have been rocking around with at the time.
Right,
so some sort of gold sort of hammer knee-length pants, pants, and then sort of like an open sort of vest top with exposing like a prepubescent teen yellowed up body.
How wonderful. Oh, yeah. Oh, was that, so was that, would have been a mixture of pride and agony for you of like, I am the king of Siam, but also don't look at me.
I mean, it was horrible. And the other thing was fake tan, not quite as advanced in those days as it is these days. So I had under my armpits and at the back of my knees, I reckon I had fake tan for at least a fortnight after we finished doing the production.
Amazing. We played Beatles in another play at the end of my high school
career. Not The Beatles.
No, not The Beatles. No. It was like the Brothers Korsakov or something. It was like called The Beatle Play. And so we'd given ourselves these stylized faces with like big red cheeks and a black kind of outline around our faces and big eyes and stuff, but it was really cheap makeup and we developed horrendous rashes from it. And so even when we were out of makeup, we had the imprint of the makeup on our faces. So like big red circles and a big red line. Amazing. School productions are incredible.
So where were you in the school production? Because I was speaking to Virginia Gay the other day and she was talking about the fact that, you know, she was never the leading lady. She was never the Juliet. She was never the Cinderella. She was always the sort of awkwardly recast, you know, male role played by a female or the wacky best friend or, you know, these sort of things. What was your role in these productions?
At the first year, it was as part of the chorus. And then the third year, I don't think I got in because the cast wasn't big enough. And then in my final year at high school, the teacher had chosen the play based on the number of parts it had for girls because there were lots of really enthusiastic girls that wanted to be in the major production. So that sounds great, but it was like, okay, there's 30 women in this, but they've all got one line. So it was called The Doctor and the Devils, and it was about the body snatchers, Burke and Hare in Edinburgh. And so I think I had one line, or two lines, I think it was like, what academy were you wanting? And hello, I think were my two lines, which I can still remember amazingly. So there was like a lot of, I loved the rehearsals and I loved the, you know, being in the show, but stage time was very small.
So I imagine then that were you looking, if you're only having a line in your sort of end of year production, is that the sort of thing that is propelling you towards a career in show business? Or at that stage, were you just doing this for fun and didn't think it was going to be what you did?
I think I thought that I was going to be an actor, but I was probably going to end up being a teacher. Because I think in my head, at that stage, girls were teachers or nurses and I hate any kind of bodily unpleasantness. So like I'll be a teacher. And my mum was a teacher. And then I thought I would like to be an actor, but I had no concept of what that actually means. Or like in my head, it was like, oh, you just go and knock on a theatre door and go, I'd like to be an actor, and they employ you. And then in my last year at high school, I did drama as a subject, which was a subject for the year below. So my parents were sort of a bit upset that I was only doing 4 seventh form subjects and a sixth form subject and worried about me getting into university. But it was all fine. But then theatre sports hit Christchurch and we started playing theatre sports. And that is really the start of where my performing career happened. And it was through doing improvised comedy. And like theatre sports, when it's bad, it's the most appalling thing you've ever experienced and you want to burn your eyes. But when it's great, it's sublime. So it was such great training for stand-up comedy to always know that you can walk out on stage, and if you've forgotten everything that you were supposed to say, you'll come up with something. And I was on stage for 5 years before I started doing stand-up. So my first attempts at stand-up weren't of the magnitude that other people's are. You know, like when people talk about, oh, you know, the first time I did it or what it felt like. And I'm like, I don't remember it that well because I was already really comfortable performing.
Theatre sports was also where I started performing at high school. And certainly the first time that I ever got laughs on stage or in any context was playing theatre sports. And what did you learn from doing improv that, you know, you sort of, I guess, take with you not only into your career, but I guess, you know, more broadly into your life? Is there like attitudes of, you know, the way that you have to perform with each other in improvisation that you take out of that?
Yeah, well, totally. Like, I think teaching stand-ups to do improv is the hardest job I've ever had, because improv is all about collaboration and making something together, and stand-up is all about you get the laughs and you win depending on how many laughs you get. Whereas improv is like, well, if I've set you up for a laugh and you've got the laugh, we still got the laugh. Like,
we got the laugh.
Yeah, we got the laugh. We all made this thing together. It was lovely, and you support other people, and it's much more, it's that collaboration, which I really love. And I also like, one of the things I love doing now is I like watching someone else's trial show and giving them notes on like, here's something, I think you should explore that, or here's a gag, or like, obviously if they've asked me, I don't just turn up to people's shows and be like, I've got some thoughts.
That'd be even better.
Yeah.
What a great show to pitch a network. Undercover Cal. Like, I like the idea too that at the start you're in disguise in each one, and then you're in the audience, and then you just like, with
pop
a,
out.
Yeah, pop out with a few minutes to go.
Will, I've got some thoughts. Yeah.
please do.
So I love that because for me, as long as the laugh is had, it doesn't really matter who gets it. So I get as much enjoyment out of someone doing a line that I've given them as I would doing it myself. Like, I love seeing that thing has been made better because we work together.
It's a hard thing to sometimes get your head around. And I do think there is a difference between, you know, that stand-up way of thinking versus that collaborative way of thinking. And it's why, you know, in LA, in New York, you know, these sort of places, they often for writers' rooms are more tempted to hire improvisers than they are to hire stand-ups as writers, because improvisers know how to build something together versus, you know, stand-ups who are really looking for, well, I'd do this line and I'd do this thing it all has to be about that. I've often said to people, you know, if I ask for advice on things, I said, if everybody's funny, like if the show's funny, the people listening to it think everybody's funny.
Yes, yeah, totally.
Right? The only time people are counting who's getting the most laughs is if the show is not working.
Yes.
Then it might get down to, well, he's funny and she's funny, but that person's not funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if the whole thing's working together,
everyone's funny. Yeah, totally. It's such a good point. Like, because you're all sharing, you're sharing the show, you're sharing the scene or whatever. And also the thing that I feel it's taught me is to say yes to stuff, because that's one of the big improv rules, is that never, you don't say no, you say yes. If someone gives you an offer, you say yes to it. And that's like taking that little leap of faith is a really a good lesson to go, well, I'll say yes and then see what happens.
Do you use that, you know, when you're constructing a show now? Because you're doing a new show for the festival.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you sit down to think about, you know, I'm going to do a new show.
Yeah.
Where does that thought process start of like actually developing, you know, a new hour, a new, you know, performance that you're going to show people?
Well, it's really changed, because it used to be that I would sit down and I would write everything out and then I would try it out once I'd kind of learn it. But now what I do is I have something that I've been thinking about, and so I'll give myself like a couple of notes about it, and then I'll go on stage and I'll talk to the audience about it. So it will be more of a conversation that then turns into me working my ideas out. Like I've got a thing that I'm working on at the moment, which is not funny yet, but will be funny-er, is that, so you and I are both animal people, like we love animals. And so when my cat died, I was in New Zealand. And so Chris took the cat to the vet, for the vet to keep the cat for a couple of days so I could come and say goodbye to him.
Yep.
And so I go, I don't know whether that's a weird thing to say to other people. Like, so I was saying to the audience, like, is it weird that he kept the cat in the fridge for me for a couple of days? And like, you could see the people in the audience that were cat people being like, no, that's totally fine. And then the people that didn't have pets were like, I'm not really sure what's happening, kind of thing. But just kind of testing stuff out and having a chat. And because improv is a conversation between people, like, I love it when the audience talks to me and we work out something together, and then that in turn becomes a story that I can tell again, and like it kind of grows. It's like growing it.
Well, I relate to that because I was overseas when my granddad died and my family did the exact same thing, just to know.
At the vet?
Just kept him in the fridge at home just so that I could say goodbye.
Oh, no, you at least want a chest freezer.
When we, one of our cats died last year, we were talking about this before we started, he died at the vet, and we brought him home while he was dead and had some time with him at home before we took him back to the vet because we were like, even though he's not, you know, here now, we want to like spend some time with him at home, and we want our last memories at least to be
a lovely at home
before we take him back to the vet. And I'm sure people think that's really weird, but for us it was very important.
Totally. And like, did your other animals, did you let them see your cat after he'd died, or was that like to kind of go, this is what's happened? Because I know that my other cat was like, I don't know where my friend's gone.
I think, we let definitely the other cat that was at home did. The dogs, I think we were careful because, you know, you don't want to
imagine.
There's a whole other horrible memory waiting to happen.
Yeah.
There.
Oh, lunch!
If you get that wrong.
Yeah.
If you look in the wrong direction for a second, that's a, this didn't work out the way that we were hoping it would.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought you were, oh.
This hasn't been as healing as I just went to the toilet. I wasn't thinking.
But the thing I loved, that I really loved about my vet, who I've followed from one vet practice to another because he's so lovely and kind, is that when he was talking to me about what he thought Spook had died of, he was still stroking him as if he was alive. And it was such a lovely, caring thing, which of course now is a piece of material where I go, he's so beautiful, or he's just really unobservant.
Mm.
Like, so the thing, you know, there's like the moment that happens when something happens that's sad or weird, and your brain immediately goes to, but the funny part of this is kind of thing. And then I work that out, but I do it on stage because I've discovered I need the feedback. And it's much more freeing, and you're not going, I forgot what I wrote for that bit. Like, you just see where it goes, and then it either works or it doesn't. And like, I record my trials and listen back to them, which is its own kind of hell, but it's really useful to go, oh yeah, there's something there. There's something in that idea. So it's kind of more working it out as I go rather than trying to write it all down beforehand and see if the whole thing works.
It makes sense to me. I mean, comedy is a conversation with an audience. And, you know, one of the most important things is to listen. And often, you know, you can get a laugh on something by just reacting to their reaction.
Yeah.
You know,
the
look on your face, or the, you know, way that you move your body in reaction to their reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're in the moment and you're listening to them and your reaction is natural, the laugh can be bigger than something that you've planned to just.
Absolutely. And I think it's that awareness that I don't even, or maybe it's like a subconscious thing, but everybody knows that that moment will never happen again. Everyone knows that that moment has only happened once. It can only happen once, you know, like you can talk about that moment again and you get a different kind of laugh from it, but that magic when somebody says something and then someone else says something and then all of a sudden this new joke has happened or this new experience has happened, or, and even for me, like sometimes in my shows, like when I chat to the audience, like I've had people admit stuff that's quite serious, like, and to be able to be in that moment and acknowledge the seriousness of it and then move on and bring it back to being funny again. That's also really exciting as well. Like it's that the moment that you're all having in the room that will never happen again.
So I'm very interested, you know, you said that you listen back to the shows, and one of the things that I've tried to promise myself this year, I'm always looking for ways to, you know, do better at what I do. And, you know, one of the ones that I've known for years, it's on my list every year. I record every show that I do, but I so rarely listen back.
Yep.
I will listen back if there's been I had 3 months off between shows at one stage this year. So before I did the Opera House, I listened to a recording of, you know, one of the shows that I'd done. I occasionally, if I improvise a huge chunk on stage that went really well and it kind of came out the right way, I might have a listen to that to, you know, see if I can replicate it. But in a general sense, I don't listen back in the way that I should. And so I decided this year that I was like, you know, much like just saying I'm going to do push-ups every day or whatever it is, I am going to just listen back to the shows no matter how hard it is to do. Now, I haven't done any shows this year yet, and I think it's partly because I know that as soon as I do, I'm going to have to start listening back to them. which is a horrible thing. But how do you find that process of being self-critical, I guess?
I mean, I'm very good at being self-critical, so it's just another way to do it. But what is really useful, what I was doing last year was, as I was driving into the gig, I was listening to the show from last night. So, like, hearing what I'd done the night before as I was about to do it again.
And you don't find that means that you take that show onto stage
that night? No, because I can go, oh, you thought you were speaking more slowly, but you actually really raced through that part, or that's a nice part, that didn't work. So it also puts me in the mindset of I'm about to go to work and I'm in the work space. Because I don't know about you, like if I can't watch a show before my show, because if I'm watching a show before my show, I'm a passenger and I'm an audience member, and it's not the same mindset of I'm a performer, I'm about to go and entertain you. And if I watch a show before my show is never great.
Funnily enough for me, same, absolutely the same, but maybe for different reasons, which is I often feel like I expel almost as much energy watching
a show as I
do performing a
show. Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Like, you know, there's a part of me that just cannot, like, relax watching a show.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I can be a real chameleon with, like, you know, just picking up. If somebody particularly has a mannerism or a distinctive way of saying a word or whatever, I will often find that if I immediately go into my show, there's still a bit of the rhythm or language of the show that I've seen previously that will influence it. And not ongoing, literally
a moment. And
for
you go,
that night, and then it goes away. But it's because you've seen that thing beforehand.
Yeah, and it's you see it in young comedians as well. Like, that, you know, I mean, when Daniel Kitson came out here for the first time, suddenly there were 100 little Daniel Kitsons running around. Like, or when I moved from New Zealand to Australia, I was like, oh, everyone's watched Greg Fleet. Mm. Like, there was that, you know, you can just see the, and I saw my first Luke McGregor copy the other day, you know, like, so it's, you can see it because you love it and you go, oh, that makes me laugh so much and I love that so much, I would like to be like that, before you realise you've just got to be yourself, and that's where the most funniness will come from.
Okay, so take me back to when you started doing stand-up. Mm-hmm. You started in New Zealand?
Yeah, in Christchurch. So we started an improv show called Scared Scriptless, which is still running 29 years later.
Right.
In Christchurch. So it was a late night show on a Friday night, and I think I was 19 when we started, and we learnt on stage. Like, so we basically learnt our craft on stage. And so we were in this unique environment where the theatre didn't charge us rent for rehearsal space. They took a nominal cut from our show on a Friday night. And so we were getting paid to learn our craft, I suppose. So I'd done that for about 5 years. So that was how, when I was at university, I paid my rent by doing improv. Like, I have had such a charmed start to do that, to not be, you know, having to make money in another way. So we did that for about 5 years, and we were doing corporate improv as well. So, you know, you go and do Christmas parties for companies and you'd have little bits of information about the company that you could throw out and, you know, oh, I can't believe you knew about Debbie, you know, kind of thing. And then the guy that was directing our company went, we need to offer a range of services for our corporate clients. We need to be able to offer stand-up as well. So you go and write some stand-up. And that's literally how it started. I hadn't ever thought, like, I remember having the thought, oh, I'd like to do stand-up, but I don't think I'm funny like that, and dismiss that thought. And then because someone else went, we need to offer another range. Like, so we went off and wrote some stand-up, and it wasn't great, but Christchurch was very generous to us because it didn't have a stand-up comedy scene. And it already knew us and trusted us from our show. Like, the show was really popular that we were doing. And so they were very lenient, I think, on four people doing shit stand-up for the first time. But because I'd come from improv, I thought that you have to write a new set every week, which now I laugh at. Like, oh, no, I've got heritage-listed material. So I thought you had to write a whole 15 minutes every week. So the second time that I did stand up, I remembered everything except the punchlines. So I would do my big long setup and the audience would be like, yep, where we go? Oh, yep, this is interesting. Where we go? Oh, no, we've moved on. We haven't got we had no closure. We've just moved on to a different topic. And, oh, no, we're gone again. We're somewhere else. So it was horrifying. So stand up was part-time compared to improv for a long time. And then even, like, New Zealand is such a small such a small population that there's in Auckland still there's only one dedicated comedy club, and it I think it has comedy 5 nights a week, and one of those is open mic, and then the second one is like for emerging comedians. But it's still like I think it was only really when I came here and I could do comedy more often, stand up more often, that I really gained some chops.
So what brought you to Australia? Because I'm interested. I that's obviously when we met.
Yeah.
But I don't have a memory necessarily of like why it was that you came over. Was that something that you always wanted to do?
Yeah, I felt that I wanted to leave New Zealand because there weren't enough places to go. There wasn't enough room for a lot of people. Like, it's changing now. Like, I think you can earn a living from comedy in New Zealand now, and I have friends that do. But at that time, I was like, there's just not the opportunities for me. And I'd also gone through an awful relationship breakup, and I was like, it'd be just really great to leave the country.
Yeah.
And so...
We've all been there.
Yeah. So I because I'd done a show here before, and, like, I had friends... I worked with Marianne Carroll in New Zealand. She was at the New Zealand Festival, and so she's obviously involved in the comedy scene over here. And so it was like I'd come over to see her, and I'd kind of meet a few other comedians, and the Melbourne Festival felt like it was something I could do. And then I came over, I did a show, I got Best Newcomer with Fiona O'Loughlin, and then the next year I came over was when things had really disintegrated at home, and Skit House had one season, and someone from Skit House had seen my show and said, do you want to audition? And I was like, do I want to audition? Like, so I was going to come anyway, but it was the difference between coming with a 15-minute spot at the local and coming to a job. So I really landed well to come here. Like, so I'd met people at the festival before. So it was kind of like coming to school halfway through the year, but you've already met the kids on holiday. So it was a really gentle landing for me.
Did you always intend to stay?
I think so. I mean, sometimes I think, oh, maybe I should have gone to the UK. But then also, it's like, oh, I've started again once.
Right.
Like, and I do love it here. And I do, my husband's Australian. My son is half and half, obviously. So, yeah, I do. I can't imagine going back to New Zealand to work for an extended period of time. But I really miss it. Like, I still really miss I miss my people and I miss my landscape. Like, I miss the green and the shape of the land. But
that's what I guess why I asked, because there is like I've loved working overseas. Mm. You know, have loved working overseas in my life and hope to do it. You know, more. But you know, as you know, there are those opportunities where you go, well, maybe I'll go and live there permanently and build my career there. And it's never been exactly what I wanted to do because. Yeah. You know, for all its faults, and there are plenty of those as well, this is where I grew up doing this. These are my people. This is my home. This is the place where I want to do it. So I always do wonder, like, you know, whether you have that same thought process of going, I wish I could be doing this same thing, you know, in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, because I feel like I'd done some TV back home, and I'd done I used to earn my living by doing voiceovers for ads, but oddly my accent is not as sought after here.
No, really?
Yeah.
We don't find it as...
No, as alluring.
Oh.
So coming here to work and getting work and work and work, like, my career has really been here. So I view this is the place that made me, kind of thing. And now I'm at that point where when I go home to New Zealand... it's not the place I left anymore. So, you know, you can sort of never go back. Like, if you go back to the farm now, it's not the same farm that you grew up on. Like, people move on, but in your head, everything should be the same as it was when you left. And so I go back now, or people will ask me about the New Zealand comedy scene, and I'll be like, I'm actually not sure. Like, I don't know. And now there's, you know, new crops of young comedians coming through that weren't there as I was leaving. So I don't know the new... young comics that are coming through New Zealand. I meet them when they come over here and do the comedy festival or things like that. So now Melbourne really is my home, but then a lot of my real heart friends still live in New Zealand. You know, it's
the New Zealand comedy scene though has exploded. You know, obviously, you know, Flight of the Conchords had a big you know, deal to do with that, yeah. but they weren't exclusively the reason for that. There are, you know, Rose Matafeo just won the, you know, the best show at the Edinburgh Festival. Like, you know, there are a range of, you know, brilliant, you know, Guy Montgomery and all these people. But also just last night I was watching a show on SBS that I'd never heard of before called Wellington Paranormal.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
Seen that
I haven't seen it, but friends of mine work on it.
Oh, boy. Yeah. It is like, it is properly funny. Like, you know, laugh out loud, silly, ridiculous, like,
so it's
funny.
the two cops from What We Do in the Shadows who, oh, that's Shadows. Did you hear that? I just went, little Kiwi. Shadows. What We Do in the Shadows. So they've taken those two characters and they've got their own.
Yes. Essentially, it's like, it's, you know, it feels a little like, you know, a very lo-fi X-Files is basically the way that they've done it.
Yeah.
But it very much in that What We Do in the Shadows world and universe. And in that style of comedy. So if you like, it is, we watched like 5 episodes in a row yesterday, having not known about it at the start of it. Yeah. And it was just so hilarious and delightful. I assume we've done like an hour or so, right? Okay. So we probably should get, like, you know, get to the meaty questions.
Yeah, okay,
I could talk to you about like this all day, but you know, there's some things that I always like to tick off on this podcast, and I feel like people would get mad if I don't. So
especially hot people.
Yeah, especially hot people. If they've tuned in for the first time, hello, hot people. Thanks for listening to the podcast. We really appreciate it. Death. Is death something that, you know, is conscious in your life? Like, do you think about death? Have you thought about death more since you've been a parent? Like, you know, how do you feel about death?
Oh, how do I feel about death? I'm not afraid of dying or being dead, but I have thoughts about how I'd like to go. Like, I'm scared of pain, so I hope that when I die it won't be painful. But in terms of other people, oh, absolutely. The moment my son was born, everything was just, you know, like, you have to keep this person alive. Like, you know, and I would literally sit up in the middle of the night and just go, I can't hear him. It's like, well, it's because he's asleep. Mm. Like, but, you know, the anxiety of this person, is like your heart's been ripped out of your chest and that person is now holding it in their hand and you just love that person so much. And they're your responsibility. I've actually been listening to Griefcast a lot, which is Carrie Lloyd's podcast, and it's conversations with comedians about people I've lost. And it has given me so much. I've just got so much out of it. It's really lovely. It's just people talking honestly about death and grief, and I don't think we do that enough. I think one of the things with my son when our cat died was that I wanted him to know that the cat had died and that he hadn't run away or gone to the farm or gone to sleep. And I was really, the thing I found difficult is because I don't believe in God, I believe that we're probably all linked in some way and there's probably something after we die, but I don't believe in kind of the Christian God.
There goes my next question, Cal.
That's
normally where this is heading.
You've just gone
right ahead, spoiled the question I had up my sleeve. Now I'm going to have to ask you what your favourite food is again.
Thai.
because that is part of it. So can we stop there just for a second?
Yeah.
So were you always of that belief?
No,
were you raised religious?
I was a born-again Christian when I was a teenager.
Oh,
I've left that out, haven't I?
Yeah.
So my mum was a Sunday school teacher. I started going to youth group and I became a born-again Christian basically because I wanted a peer group. Like, looking back, that's what it was about. And so at one stage when a charismatic youth leader was like, who feels the presence of Jesus, and other people were putting their hands up, I was like, I guess I do.
Yep.
But I left that. I stopped going to church when it was around the time there was a homosexual law reform bill happened in New Zealand. So it was to make it legal for gay men to have sex with each other. The age of 16, I think. I can't really remember the details, but at that time our youth group leaders were saying homosexuality is a sin and it's the devil, and they were also saying things like the devil made Dungeons and Dragons, so they were off on a lot of
the devil
tangents.
Was doing a lot of work.
He was busy. And my best friend came out to me, and another friend's older brother who I really loved was gay, and one of my favourite teachers was gay, and that made me go, oh, I don't believe that these people are the devil. I think you might be wrong about some other stuff as well. And I just kind of left it behind then. And I don't know. I believe if there is a God, I don't think he or she or it or they would make something so amazing and then fuck it up. Like, I don't, what's the point? What's the, like, you know, building a thing out of Lego and then blowtorching it and going, it's my plan. Like, I don't believe in that stuff anymore because it doesn't make sense to me. But I believe that humans are amazing, and I think I love the thought that we will know the answer when we die of what happens to us. And if there's nothing, then what is there to worry about? Because we'll never know. But for that instant, we're like, oh, fuck, there's nothing. Like, or there is something and we find out the answer and whether we come back or whatever. I just can't buy into the idea of a God that punishes people and would do such cruel things or allow such cruel things to happen that happen in the world.
What do you say to, you know, when you're raising a child, when that question comes up?
This is the thing. So when the cat died, I had no, he's gone to heaven. I didn't have that to fall back on because I don't know if there is a heaven. So what I said to my son was, the little spark that makes you you has twinkled away. And I don't know where that's gone, but like his body has got sick and the little spark inside him that makes him has twinkled away. And his body will go back to the earth and then, you know, plants will grow and things like that. And he was quite happy. He started calling it the little sparkle. And so he had, like, which is, I guess, an idea of a soul, I guess, is that, but like the part that makes you you is no longer in the body. The body has worn out and the sparkle has no use for the body anymore, kind of thing. So he was pretty happy with that.
I'm pretty happy with that. I've got to be honest, that comforted me a little bit.
But also the thing about kids is they don't have the emotional weight that we have with death. So that when Digby's great-grandmother died, she died not long after the cat did. Two separate isolated incidents. But we were upset about it, but he wasn't that upset about it because he doesn't have a lifetime of beliefs and learnings about death. And so Nanny had died and that wasn't necessarily a long-lastingly sad thing. But when I was talking, because I talked to him that she was really sick and that she lived in, she didn't live in Melbourne, so we didn't see her that often, like he'd met her twice, I think. And because he was quite little at this point, so we were in the car after she died, and that's always a really good place to have conversations as well because you're together, but it's not intense. You're not looking each other in the eye. You can just have a chat. And so I said, oh, you know that, you know Nanny who was sick, that Nanny has died. And he said, yes, Nanny's been scrapped. And I went, Nanny's had a scrap? And he goes, no, they've taken her to the smelter's yard. Nanny's been scrapped. And his understanding was Thomas the Tank Engine. So when old engines or wagons reach the end of their lifespan, they go to the smelter's yard and get melted down and they're scrapped. And so when I said she's died, he was like, oh yeah, she's been scrapped. So that, and I was like, it's quite brutal, but that's pretty much what's happened. Like,
I mean, it is, yeah. But I like your sparkle bit better,
yeah.
To be honest. I'm more happy with little sparkle than I am with being scrapped.
Yeah, but because he doesn't have that emotional weight on it, he was like, oh yeah, this is just a different way of explaining it. And so like when the cat died, it was hard because he loved the cat and I'd be like, well, Pod died. And then he understood that, we thought. And then he'd be like, well, but when is Pod coming home from the vet? And I was like, well, Pod's never coming home from the vet. And then we had him cremated, the cat, and we've got him in a wee tin. And so he was quite interested in the wee tin. Like, and then it was about 6 months later, he was like, how did the cat get small enough to go in the tin? Because I'd never explained what we'd done and I didn't want to just go, we burnt him. So I was like, oh, you go to the special place after you die, you get really, really hot, your body crumbles to ash and that's what's left. And he was happy with that explanation. But then we had like a 36 degree day and he came running inside and he's like, are we going to die? like he'd just gone, oh, well, when it gets really hot, we all just die. And not worried about it, but just like, well, this is what you've told me.
What you probably should have sat him down is gone, yes, it's a thing called climate change.
Yeah.
And you are probably all going to die because of it.
In
so
your
this
lifetime,
is a good day.
My darling. Yeah.
This is a really good day to learn an important lesson about your future.
Yeah. Me and your dad will be fine, but probably when you're 50, you're going to be floating on a tiny iceberg.
Do you think about that? I always think with my friends who have children that, you know, you can't help but know that, you know, if the scientists are right, that the news for our planet is not good and the effects of it may be reasonably immediate. Now, look, let's be honest. We live in Australia and we live, you know, a very middle-class existence, both as a country and, you know, us individually.
Yep.
You know, we're not going to be the first people that, you know, climate change comes for. We're not going to be the, you know, the people who've had to leave their, you know, countries because of, you know, the devastating effects. You know, they're going to be poor brown people first and foremost, and then eventually. But the effects will, you know, everybody in the world is going to feel those effects, and children, you know, of that generation are going to have to deal with the mistakes that we have made and the people before us have made. So how do you raise, you know, your child just having that knowledge? Do you just block it out? Do you try to in some way funnel that into, you know, your everyday existence? Like how does that affect it, or does it not affect it at all?
I guess I don't say to him, you know, the world's fucked, darling. Like I don't like, and we don't watch the news with him and stuff. Like we talk about things, but we don't let him see the news because there's just so much horror on it.
Yeah.
So, but we talk about things that are good for the environment, like what we should recycle stuff, or, you know, this is what we do because of this. Like I just talk to him about stuff, just as it comes up. But I haven't talked about stuff on a global level. But then I know he talks about stuff like that at school. I know that they talk about all sorts of different things, but you know, just things like talking about refugees and asylum seekers and things like that, and being aware that I'm the person that calibrates his moral compass. You know, me and his dad are the people who set him up to be kind, or to be someone who's like, fuck off, we're full, which we're not doing. But do you know what I mean?
Like, it'd be ironic,
wouldn't
it?
Oh yeah, I was the last one. I was the last one.
Taking our jobs. all right, so that's death.
Yep.
And that's having children. The only thing that I really would love to talk to you about is there a moment in your life that if you had your time again, you'd do something differently? Now, I know this is an interesting question because, you know, there's a school of thought that is, well, everything that has happened to me so far has brought me to where I am now. And if you take one of those pieces out, you don't know
where you'll end up
and what things you learnt from that. And maybe it was the process of, you know, dealing with that thing or recovering from that thing or feeling guilty about that thing that shaped you into the person that you became. But is there something that in your mind where you go, I wish I had my time over. I wish I just would have done that differently.
I feel like maybe there's career-wise, I should have pushed myself harder. I should have been more, I should have played the game a bit more, because I think I could have ended up in different places in terms of radio and things if I'd kind of been more of a hard ass as opposed to just thinking that everybody acts in an honourable way. Kind of, I think there's probably a part of me that's too naive for my own good. Like even now I still like figure things out a little bit too late where I go, I should have done that differently. But I also espouse the thing of like everything that you've done leads you to this point. So if I hadn't done this, if I hadn't had a bad relationship, I wouldn't have ended up coming to Australia. I wouldn't have my son and my husband and, you know, all of those things. So, but one of the things that I think about is that when my grandfather was, he'd had a stroke and I was 14. And it's such a weird moment to think about. So he was in a wheelchair and we were at my grandparents' house, and I was in the room with him, and he started crying and saying he was useless and that nobody loved him, and I didn't know what to do, and I left the room because I was overwhelmed. And I think about that and I wish that I had been able to tell him. And how strange that 34 years later I can still feel that regret. But oh, Will Anderson, this wasn't supposed to happen.
Oh, I mean, I feel like Andrew Denton all of a sudden.
I've cried at Antiques Roadshow, so this isn't out of the ordinary for me. But
no, I'm a crier too.
Yeah, but
do you encourage your child to cry?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And the thing that it's done for me, like I so regret not telling him that I loved him. But I don't leave things unsaid. Oh, I hate the sound of myself crying. It's ridiculous. I've never left things unsaid. Like, I think it's so important that everybody knows how you feel about them. I never want any of the people I love to be in any doubt that how much they matter to me. It would be great if I could turn this on when I'm doing auditions.
I mean, it's really compelling. I got to be honest with you.
But yeah, like I so did not expect that to happen.
I think, thought though, the idea, the regret of not letting somebody know what you really think. And we so often in our lives, you know, don't say to other people what we really think because we're nervous or we
don't
feel that
those
things won't come back in the same way or that we'll be an idiot or whatever it is. And I think that so many people probably listening to this relate to that idea of going, I just wish that I had been able to tell that person. You know, we're having this debate about, you know, drug use in our society at the moment. And, you know, like I think that one of the overlooked things when people talk about, you know, recreational drug use is that often when you're in your sort of early 20s, the idea of using recreational drugs gives people the capacity to say things to people that they wish they could say without using recreational drugs.
Yeah.
It's the cliche of the people, you know, off their heads on, you know, ecstasy in the corner telling each other that they love them. But I think that it, sometimes that plays a really important role in getting people to that stage where they're comfortable to sit down and actually say to their friends that they love them.
Yeah. And I'm also really clear about if someone has done something good to tell that person, you know, like whether you've done a good job or, you know, like for me at the moment, it's if I see a friend's book in a bookshop, I send them a photo of the book. Like, I think we should just celebrate each other.
I think that's a really beautiful note to leave it on. I'm going to celebrate you by telling everybody to watch your Netflix special, which is on Comedians of the World. And so you go onto Netflix and you go, like, there's a tile that'll say Comedians of the World. And
bright yellow.
And then they can search for your special, for Joel Creasy's special, for Naz's special,
Deanne
Smith, Ursula Carlson.
Martin.
A whole bunch of really brilliant people who've done specials, but, you know, a whole bunch of locals and a few people have been on this podcast. So please go and find those. And your brand new show, where are you taking it to?
It is going to the Melbourne Comedy Festival, Adelaide Fringe, going to Sydney, going to Perth.
Okay. And what is it called?
It's called Gifted Underachiever.
And do you know what it's about? At this stage, when's the first time you do it?
I do it in Adelaide at the end of February. So at this stage...
So we're recording this on the 25th of January
to
give people context.
Yes.
And so your first performance is... do you know the date?
No, I don't even know the date. Okay. Well, I'm living week by week.
Very different existence to what I have.
Well, it's because it's the end of February. Like normally I'd be going, oh shit, it's next week. But
so you've got about a month. About a month out from, you know, doing the show. Yep. Where are you at in relation to the show?
I've got 40 minutes of 55 and I haven't written the tough parts yet. So I've got all the funny stuff, but I haven't written the stuff that I really, that feels dangerous to say, which is the way it works. For me, is like I'm like, oh, I want to have an opinion, but I'm nervous about having an opinion. I don't want to get backlash. Like, so the stuff that's important to me, I'm still thinking about, and then I'm putting jokes around that.
Well, I'm not going to leave this left unsaid. I love you. I think you're the best, and I'm so pleased that you came and did this. And I hope the show is absolutely fantastic. And thanks for doing it today.
Thanks, Will.